Welcome to the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show. This is half an hour or so of your guide to better cricket. Doesn't matter who you are or where you are, we're here to help you out. And who are we? Well, my name is David Hinchliffe. I look after things here, and helping me to help you is the director of cricket at Millfield School. It's Mark Garraway. Hello, Gareth. How are you?
I'm really well, thanks very much. Lovely and sunny down here today. Beautiful. And hopefully it'll stay there for the next few weeks because we're getting started, as you know, in not too long a time.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. No Sam Lavery this week for the second week in a row. He's in Sri Lanka at the moment, and we were just discussing how his team might have done. We think maybe they might be struggling in alien conditions.
Yeah, and it isn't easy over there, having lost a test series over there, but actually won a one-day series. It's not an easy place to go, and Sri Lankans are brilliantly competitive at playing. And you know, they know their conditions, just like I suppose English players know their conditions and Australians know theirs and so on and so forth. But touring is a very difficult thing to go to places and win, that is for sure.
Oh, for sure, yeah. And conditions is actually one of those things, just as a little aside, conditions is one of those things that it's so hard to prepare for. If you're used to one thing and you go into another one, it's always difficult, isn't it? If you've grown up in conditions, that's totally different from even if you go on 5 training camps in 5 years before you play a test match. It's still got a big disadvantage over a guy who's been playing cricket in those conditions since he was 2 years old.
Absolutely. And all you're doing is trying to narrow that gap as much and learn as much as you can and learn, yeah, I suppose, in an accelerated fashion over those guys that are growing up in those environments. And I think that's one of the things that allows cricket to be such a special game, is that lots of people nowadays in particular are getting the opportunity to tour overseas and gather these experiences, these perspectives, and to compete in conditions which are different and compete against different types of cricketers. And it's a very worldwide game now, certainly much more so than it was 20 or 30 years ago.
Oh yeah, and there's not many sports where the playing conditions make such a huge difference to the way that the game is played, but it really does make almost close to it being a different game when you compare playing in England in May when it's a bit soggy and it's hooping around a bit, and then India in the height of summer when it's boiling hot, and Australia, and just every country that plays test cricket has a different set of conditions that are unique and give such an advantage to people and make the game so fascinating. So it's great to see, really, but a challenge for those in the middle of trying to learn it.
It is, and that's what I think has been quite impressive about the recent India-Australia series, is that it's been an incredibly well-fought series. In particular, that first test match when Australia came out of the blocks and looked as if they'd got their preparation as right as they possibly could have done, winning by a huge margin, which set the series up. But it's been very competitive, and you know, hats off to the Australians, because you know, it's not an easy place to go and compete in, as England found out recently. But they really made a good fist of it, and it was super, super cricket to watch.
I think so. And I think, obviously, with Monty being involved with Australia, he must have had a big influence on those guys, and you know, made all the difference.
Well, I don't know about all the difference, but it's brilliant. It's brilliant to see Monty back in game. The game's a better place for having Monty, you know, back to where he was as a bloke and passionate about the game and doing the right things. And there's definitely a good little coach in there, that is for sure.
All those things, I suppose, that we've been talking about so far, learning new conditions and character of people, I guess you can focus in on one word, which is resilience, which is one thing that I wanted to talk about this week. And resilience is one of those words that gets bandied about and it often doesn't get defined very clearly on what it really is. So I wanted to sort of get your views on that, Gareth, and find out, when you're thinking about having guys who have got resilience when it comes to cricket, and I suppose in the rest of their life as well, but specifically cricket, what do you look for in guys who are resilient, and how do you get them there if they need to develop that part of the game?
Well, certainly in my experience, resilience and perspective, particularly in cricket, are very, very much interlinked. Because, you know, as we discussed a lot, cricket's a game of failure, and therefore people's level of resilience is tested more in cricket than it is maybe in other sports or other pastimes. You know, the best players in the world, one out of three innings, that they would get a good score, and that's the best players in the world. You know, Sachin was precisely one every three, and he was pretty good at it. So, you know, he was failing two out of every three across his career. So we get tested in our resilience. And what we see is people that have got perspective, have got an understanding that things can turn around. And that's why it's always important that when you've got a player who has shown that they can cope at that level and has had success in the past, I think it's really important to stick with them, because inevitably there's going to be periods of times where they don't score runs. And just look at Virat Kohli in this series we've just spoken about. You know, I think he scored 49 runs in the whole of the series. But you're not going to drop a Virat Kohli, because you know that he's got the skills, the attributes and the characteristics to bounce back, which is what ultimately perspective and resilience are all about, is being able to bounce back from adversity. And it's been really interesting listening to him talk about the people that are now having a bit of a pop out, because people have to say things, people have to write articles, people have to do podcasts like we do, and they sort of justify their experience about, you know, trying to analyse why he's failing now and his career's on the rocks and all of those things. And he accepts that that stuff is going to happen. He accepts that people are going to talk about what he's going to do, but ultimately he's just going to work harder and harder. And we know, because he understands that cricket is a game where you'll have periods of time where everything goes well, like the England series, and then you'll get periods of time where everything doesn't go well, just like this series. And perspective is absolutely crucial. For me, as a player growing up, I didn't really have perspective. If I was succeeding a lot, I was the best player in the world in my own head, and if I wasn't succeeding a lot, I was the worst player in the world. And ultimately, my lack of perspective meant that I wasn't resilient when I started to not score runs, and often I would be in a trough for a long period of time, and often the only way I would come out of it is if I had a period of a bit of luck and got dropped a couple of times and end up getting 70, and then all of a sudden I feel like I'm a good player again. And the bottom line is that the greatest players don't doubt themselves, because they understand the game. They have a perspective around success and failure, and as a result have the ability to bounce back. Alistair Cook is another classic example of somebody who has got great levels of perspective and great levels of resilience, and to me the two are interlinked.
Yeah, that word perspective is a great one, isn't it? And sometimes just taking a step back from what's currently happening and thinking longer term, even if it's a month ahead, or maybe it's a year ahead, maybe it's 5 years ahead, and saying to yourself, okay, well, where do I want to be in that time, and how am I going to get there? That's so much more powerful. That taking that longer perspective almost is so much more powerful. So that's a great word, perspective. And another one that I like a lot is acceptance. And you said that as well. And that is accepting the things that you can't change and you can't control, because there's going to be loads of those. And if you can accept those, and then when you are in some kind of adverse situation, you can then think to yourself, okay, what action can I actually take here? And then you can talk about that perspective and say, okay, what action can I take now? What action can I take in the medium term? What action can I take in the long term? Then those things, it's almost like they're just things that happen, and your response to them is just to keep on trucking. You know, you might adjust your course now and again, but basically, you know that some things are going to happen, and you just get on with getting on. And you either accept you accept the things that you can't control, and you get on with changing the things that you can control and developing. And I think that's really where resilience comes into its own, is not in using the word just by saying to someone, be more resilient. That's not going to make them more resilient. But where resilient comes into its own is the actual things that you do. And if you're doing the right things, then you will be resilient. It won't be a weird concept that is far in the distance to you. You know, it's just resilience just means, to me anyway, resilience just means the things that you do in whatever the situation that you're in.
Yeah, definitely. And I think the guys that we see come out off the back of a bit of poor form or not getting wickets. So, you know, how many times has Jimmy Anderson been doubted over the years? And at the time of the biggest doubt, where he's had a period of, I don't know, 5 or 6 games where he hasn't got a fifer, and everybody starts talking about it in the press because they recognise that he hasn't got a fifer, then, you know, the speculation rises, and what does he go out and do? He goes out and gets a fifer. And everybody goes, oh, you must be, you know, you're absolutely fantastic because you're under this pressure. But the bottom line is that if he bowls enough, because he's a good quality player, because he's worked at his skills, that fifer is around the corner. It might be a longer corner than you want it to be sometimes, but it is only around the corner. And I think too many people forget that.
I'd say the other thing that is often not considered when you think about resilience, because often you think about it as a, you know, a psychological thing, is that your fitness does make a difference, I think, as well. You know, if you're fitter, if you're stronger, then you can be more focused. And if you can be more focused, then you can do the things that you want to do more easily. So I think it's an extra point. It's not the center of it, but it's certainly worth saying that resilience and a lot of psychological things, but resilience particularly, is tied in quite strongly to your fitness. So even if you don't think of fitness as important in terms of, you know, being able to score 100 runs because you know you only ever play in 20 matches and you don't want to play a long innings because you're never going to bat more than 20 overs anyway. But even in those kind of situations, then you can still draw on the fitness side of things to improve the mental side of things.
And that was something that came up in Virat Kohli's post-series interviews after they clinched that series against Australia, was that he felt that the team had moved on from a physical point of view, that the work that they had done had come through in the Test series, and not just the 11 that got picked in the first Test match, but actually across a broader squad, because they had a number of people rotate around the bowlers or batters losing form, or in his case having an injury. Which meant that the whole squad was used. But he cited that the fitness that they had meant that they were able to be stronger, to be mentally more robust when Australia put the pressure on in 2 or 3 situations. And he felt that previous Indian sides would have caved in under that amount of pressure instead of holding strong. So, yeah, I agree with you on that. And part of the thing about bleep tests and yo-yos and stuff like that, for me, isn't the score that somebody gets at the end, whilst that's got an importance. It's how they got there, how they battled through the demons that inevitably sit on your shoulder and tell you to stop, because they're the same things that will allow you to be successful when you're up against it out in the middle playing cricket.
Now it's time for the mailbag on the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show. A couple of questions that have been sent in by listeners to the show, or maybe readers to the Pitch Vision website. Either way, what we do is we answer those questions and then we decide on the best question of the week, which wins a prize of an online coaching course from Pitch Vision Academy at pitchvision.com. If you want to send your question in to us for future shows, you can do that by emailing coach@pitchvision.com, or you can get in touch with us through social media, which we'll tell you about towards the end of the show. And the first question this week is coming from Scott. And Scott says, how important are statistical goals in providing motivation for the coming season? So presumably Scott is at very least in the Northern Hemisphere. Sounds like possibly the UK, but you never know. But what do you think anyway, Gareth? Statistical goals, how do you do it?
Well, I think statistical goals are useful with all goal setting. However, there will be certain personality types and certain individuals that will be motivated more by numbers than others. And, you know, somebody like Alistair Cook is hugely motivated, not just by numbers, but by records. And that's what he's chasing, really, is chasing knocking off people off the all-time run scorers, knocking off the hundreds list, sticking himself out in front as much as he can as a as an England leading run scorer, to be able to set the benchmark for others to follow and try and eclipse. And you know, so some people are very motivated by numbers, yet other people within the same side, and thinking back a few years to Kevin Peterson, wasn't really particularly motivated by numbers. He was more motivated by how he looked and how stylish he was and all of those things. But both were phenomenally good cricketers within the same setup. So I think when it comes to motivations, knowing yourself is massively important when it comes to setting your targets for the summer. Obviously, numbers do play a part, because, you know, if your pure motivation is to hit one good cricket shot every game, you know, you might do that, make six, and then get out every game, but you've hit your target. But actually, you've probably ended up being demoted 3 11s in the process. So, you know, numbers and currency of batters is runs and wickets for bowlers exactly the same. We need to be hitting some targets, but some people will be more motivated than others to the extent of those numbers are used. So know yourself, Scott, and I think just for the fact that you've asked the question, you probably do want to have some element of numbers in there. So it's important to be realistic, I think, when you put these in, and not just realistic about your game, but also have a look at what other people have achieved, top performers, people that you're trying to chase down, what they've achieved over the same amount of matches in the same conditions, because then you'll be setting some targets which are realistic, that can be measurable against others that have played in the same league, so on and so forth. So it's easy to go, I want to score 1,000 runs in this season, but you know, if four games are going to be washed out, if you're going to bat first a number of games and you've got a brilliant bowling attack and you're only going to be chasing 120 as a team total, then it's very difficult for people to get up to 1,000 runs. So you've got to make sure that they're realistic, that they have a context to them, but also they're pertinent to yourself as well. So as long as you follow those rules, I don't think you can go too far wrong in sticking some numbers in.
Yeah, that realistic one is really important, isn't it? As you said, it's very easy to set the dream target, and then, you know, like you say, the first game a team is bowled out for 100, and you know, you don't even get to bat, and then it rains 1 week, and you know, and then you do get a good ball, and then, you know, you play a bad shot, and suddenly you've played five games and you score 12 runs, and you're suddenly thinking, well, hang on a minute, that 1,000 was a bit ambitious in the first place. So I think when it comes to, well, it's that classic. It's almost old fashioned now, isn't it? You know, that whole idea of saying goals should be smart, you know, specific, measurable, achievable, realistic, and time based. And that's a pretty good rule of thumb when you're thinking about setting any kind of target. If you can set a target that meets all of those, then you are going to be challenging yourself in a way that is controlled, and not in a way that is completely out of the question if any single thing goes wrong. I had a conversation with a chap a few weeks ago about how the team are going to do this year, and he said, well, we should win every game. And I said, well, that's a fantastic aim to have, but what happens if we come up against a team whose pro is on fire one day and, you know, knocks us over for 80, and then they knock them off no bother at all? You know, suddenly the whole season's completely ruined because we haven't won every game, and it's been something which we haven't been able to do about in the first place. So you've got to be careful with numbers, but if you stick to that smart idea, then you're not going to go too far wrong, are you, Gareth?
No, and I think the crucial thing is to reflect on them and review them at that sort of, you know, quarterly, over the course of that season, really. Because, for example, if you have an injury that leaves you out for three games, then the chances of you hitting that 1,000 runs or whatever your target is going to be reduced. So you need to factor all of that stuff in accordingly, and review it every now and again. You know, I think we've all been there, in the Northern Hemisphere in particular, where the first few games of a season are affected by rain, which then does affect the length of the game and what people can achieve within that game. So have a review. Don't just stick to them. Don't be dogmatic around that 1,000. The crucial thing is that you can keep striving forward and keep striving to hit things. And certainly, again, when we didn't know as much about setting targets as we do now, way back when I was playing, I'd set a number at the beginning of the year and then it would be completely demotivated and I probably wouldn't even look at it after about five games in. And actually, for me, in the seasons where I didn't set myself any goals, I actually achieved more, ironically. And that's when I got a little bit more understanding of what I needed, and how I judge myself. So I ended up judging myself on how many days of a year of a season was I happy. And often that was the thing that, because I'm notoriously grumpy when I'm playing cricket. So if I was happy, then I was often giving myself the best chance of success. So, you know, that was a very simple target. I just increased the numbers of days that I wanted to be happy and work my way towards that, rather than worrying too much about the outcomes, because the outcomes tend to look after themselves.
That is a cracker. That is a cracker. One thing that I've been sort of messing around with for this cricket season for our team in terms of setting a target when batting first, which of course is almost impossibly difficult. I've sort of come up with this idea of having three sort of numbers in mind. The first one is sort of what's minimum viable. The second one is kind of what we would consider to be par. And the third one is, you know, if we really stretch it, how far can we go? And even that third one is sort of, well, you know, we're not going to just try and get to 250 and stop. If it's going well, we can sail past that. Obviously, we're going to. But I like the idea of a sort of having a kind of almost having a woolly range of numbers, and then you can at any given point in the game, you can go, well, you know, we're doing all right because we've gone past the par score now, what we consider to be the par score. So, you know, let's keep on going. But, you know, looking in historical context, getting to 175 on this ground gives us a great advantage. So that's something that I'm going to be experimenting a little bit with this year as well. And that's not for individual goals, obviously. That's for trying to put a little bit of context in mind when it comes to batting first. Because certainly in the club cricket I've played, everyone goes, oh, well, 200, that's what we need to get today. And that's not necessarily true. So, you know, trying to put a bit more context on it this year.
Well, we looked at it. The last time I played club cricket, it was a long time ago now. But we looked at our bowling attack and thought that we had a good bowling attack for most of the conditions that we were going to be playing in. Mm. And so having a look at the scorecards from around the grounds, and in particular on our home one, which is the most relevant, there's half our games were going to be there. We decided that the number 180 would mean if we got 180, then we'd have to bowl like planks or miss lots and lots of chances for us to be at risk of losing the game. So we used to get to 180, and then the game after 180 was to see how big we could make the winning margin. And that was literally as simple as we kept it. So we batted relatively conservatively up to 180, and then depending on the number of overs left, meant that the number of runs that we were going to set was going to be bigger and bigger. So if we got there in 40 and we were playing a 50 over game, then obviously we were going to be in a fairly strong position. So often we get to 183 down because that was our initial target, and we'd end up getting 270 to 300 most weeks because we'd honestly wanted to get 180 first. That was, you know, the way that we worked out in the league that we were in at the time and playing where we did, that we felt that was the best way, and there was 100% correlation between us doing that and winning. The side lost a game at the beginning of the year before I played, but that had no relevance to whether they won or lost. Where they got 180 and lost, but the rest of the time we got 180, we won actually, or more, we won at a canter because we were scoring well over that.
Yeah, and that's, I guess that the danger also needs to be pointed out here is that, especially when it comes to centre target batting first, you don't want to say, we get to that number and we'll do that in over number 49, because then, you know, job well done. You like you say, Gareth, you want it to be more of a guideline than a hard and fast, you know, we must get to this or we fail, and if we get to this, we're definitely going to win. It's a lot more it's a lot more nuanced than that. So yeah, having that number in mind, it reassures you a bit. What you don't want to do is get so reassured that you just walk out to bowl and think, oh great, you know, we've already won, all we need to do is just turn her arm over a couple of times and they'll roll over for us and we've won the game. You still got to play well. And so that's the danger of numbers, isn't it? It can be a false sense of security sometimes as well. So you have to be aware of that. But as long as you're aware of that, you've got the tools.
And I think that was shown, wasn't it, at the last 50-over World Cup, where England went in and scored over 300 three times, I think it was, and ended up having their trousers pulled down, didn't they, on every single time, because the opposition were knocking them off with turnovers to go. And that was just a lack of understanding of actually what the game had done over the previous 6 to 12 months, where there had been a significant upturn in the scores that were being hit in Australian and New Zealand conditions, and that wasn't applied into their goal settings. So every time, if you remember rightly, Owen Morgan was going out there and talking, saying, oh, we'll consult the numbers. Well, the fact was that England had the wrong numbers, because they were taking it from all around the world rather than taking it from the environments in which they were playing. And there had been that big upturn in the previous 8 months in Australia and New Zealand cricket around the types of scores that were being knocked off. And in the end, it was 400, which in that World Cup, which was becoming more nearer the par than three.
Next question is from Moolish. And Moolish says, I am a diehard cricket fan. I've just completed my degree and I want to become an analyst. What can I do for that? Any help? We don't know what his degree is the problem there, but I guess we'll have to assume that it's not specifically to do with cricket analysis.
Yeah, well, let's assume that, I mean, if it is, then obviously you've got a qualification behind you, which is useful. If it's not, and it's a sports science-based thing, then you probably have studied some element of analysis and performance analysis within your course. And if it's something completely unrelated to it, it's still not the end of the world at all, because, as you say, you're a cricket fan and you've got an interest. I suppose the question is, how many of the environments around you are actually utilising analysts within their coaching staffs and in support of their coaching staff? So do a bit of homework around your immediate environments, and if there's nobody in your immediate environments, then do a bit of homework around other places where you could feasibly put yourself to be able to offer your services. But one thing I will say is that this is an area now which is, there's a lot of people in this area now, not just as cricket fans, but analysts that are going to universities doing performance analysis. We have one here at school, and every time that we hold interviews, we get 60 or so applicants, and we have to narrow that down to 5. So be aware that this is a popular course now at universities, and therefore the marketplace is full of people. In the same way as physios, sports masseuses, and strength and conditioning coaches, it's a massively flooded market now. So if you haven't got an element of that within any degree, then can you upgrade? Can you add something on? Can you gain some experience before you offer yourself to somebody as a potential analyst? Because there's going to be a load of people wanting to do exactly the same thing. So that would be my first bit of advice. The second thing, I think the best analysts for me aren't the ones that look at it through a cricket lens. They're the ones that look at it through a different type of lens, sort of questioning cricket almost, because we know that there are certain metrics that we are following nowadays, and the fact is that everybody is following those pretty much. Everybody knows what the par scores are on grounds, everybody knows how strike rates are important in certain formats and not so important in others. People know what the key performance indicators are, and I suppose it's the best analysts that I've worked with have been the ones that have looked at the game completely differently. The ones that are trying to find the next thing, as opposed to just merely interpreting statistics based on what is the current thinking. Because ultimately, that it's the next competitive edge, isn't it? So you think about somebody like Team Sky and their cycling team, which have come under a lot of scrutiny recently, but they've made their name through looking at different ways of making 1% or 2% gains, as opposed to just merely doing exactly the same as everybody else. You know, they're the first people that would look into sleeping patterns, and they took that to the next level by making sure that people took their own pillows to their hotels. Then they changed the mattresses and the bed linen so you were completely consistent wherever you stay. Now they're making sure that somebody goes ahead and hoovers the floors and and cleans the rooms in a specific way to produce the the instance of infection. So this has all come off of analytics. This has all come off people looking at stuff through a different lens and coming up with a different approach that could make not just 1 or 2% of difference, but maybe still 5 or 10% on the opposition who aren't thinking in that way. So to me, make sure that you get on the shortlist would be my first thing, because it's a massive market. So make sure that the prerequisites that people are asking in job descriptions you are able to meet, otherwise you won't get on the shortlist. And even if you do have all of those things, what makes your CV stand out more than anybody else? Because they are going to cut a lot of people that meet all of the criteria. And secondly, can you look at cricket in a different way? Because those guys are going to be the future of the game within cricket. And it will be the side that wins the next World Cup will be the one that, yes, does all of the basics of the game really well, but more importantly, has got the head start on the next big thing in limited overs cricket.
It's quite tricky, I suppose, isn't it, to directly draw a line between what an analyst does and performance. It's kind of what I'm trying to say, I suppose, is it's quite hard to prove what you're doing is making a difference. I guess if you're at the higher levels, it's easier. But certainly, if you're trying to do analysis stuff at lower levels of the game, you know, whether it's academy cricket, school cricket, club cricket, stuff like that, there are things you can bring in, but you can never be quite sure as to what influence it has. So being able to prove that, I suppose, is one of the most powerful things you can do, because you can put experience on a CV, but if you can put experience and success on a CV, that's one extra step forward, isn't it? What do you think, Gary? Do you think it's a hard thing to prove what kind of influence analysis has?
I think it's really difficult, but I also think the same for coaching, I'll be honest.
Yeah, that's true.
I think it's really difficult, and in fact, the people that try to do it, I think, are missing the boat. Because the game's played by cricketers, isn't it? And, how can I assess my impact on cricketers? The bottom line is it shouldn't be me that's assessing that. And the same thing for analysts. You know, how many games did I have a significant influence on winning for England whilst I was an analyst? Admittedly, I wasn't a particularly good analyst, and there's lots out there that are significantly better than I was when I did it. But I reckon there were 2, maybe 3 games of cricket that I influenced. One was through analysis, and one was just through understanding cricket pretty well. And the one through analysis, we didn't have Hawkeye in a series, and so I didn't get the Hawkeye stats at the end of a game, and I worked out by re-watching the game ball by ball and logging down on a piece of paper what paces somebody bowled, I realised that there was a little bit of a pattern that maybe our bowlers could copy. And our bowlers were Jimmy Anderson, who's obviously fairly brilliant, Stuart Broad, who was really open to the idea, and somebody else who I can't remember off the top of my head, and they all went, Ryan Sidebottom. And they learned this stuff, practiced it, then applied it, and we ended up winning the series in Sri Lanka, actually, of all places, out there, because we applied that stuff. Probably, you know, I helped that process by making them aware of it, but ultimately it was their skill that turned the series around for us. And as a coach, it's not really my place to say whether I made a difference or not, to be honest. It's for the players to think or say or not say. So I think it's a tough one to prove or disprove. And the people that are trying to do that, I think you could probably be applying your energies into better things, mate.
Right. Yeah, that's very true, yeah. And I'll just tell you one little thing that I've been thinking about. This is still incubating, so I don't know whether this will ever be something. But maybe this will help our correspondent. What was his name? It was
Moolish.
Moolish, yeah, Moolish. Maybe it won't. So take it with a pinch of salt. Being in Scotland, of course, weather is always high on my mind. But this year, I'm just going to keep a little record of how much it rains. And see if there's any correlation between the amount of rain that we get and the scores that occur at our home ground.
I thought you were going to say and the amount of puddles.
And the amount of puddles. Yeah. Yeah. There's definitely a correlation between that. I can tell you that now. I don't need to look at the data for that one. It might be nothing, but you know, I've got a spreadsheet set up that is automatically tracking how much it rains. So all I have to do is look at that and then look at the scores and see if there's any correlation between them.
Ah, nice.
And that is the end of the show for another week. We are going to head off, but before we do that, we've just got a little bit of housekeeping to do. The main thing, of course, is to decide on the winner of this week's competition. The online coaching course from Pitch Vision Academy at pitchvision.com is up for grabs. And we had Scott's question about statistical goals and Moolish's questions about becoming an analyst. Which one did you prefer this week, Gareth?
Two top questions, but I'm going to go for Moolish. One, because, you know, analysis is an area of the game that's growing. I did pretend to be one for a while, but most importantly, and we go back to some old school criteria, Moolish is a fantastic name.
It is, yeah. Well done, Moolish, for your name and for your question. And for winning the prize. I guess if someone else was listening and they wanted to send in their question, get it answered and win the prize, how could they get in touch with us?
They could give us a call on 0203 239 7543 or drop us an email on coach@pitchvision.com.
That is correct. There are other ways to get in touch with us as well. You can get us through social media. PitchVision has its own way of getting in touch. So if you go to pitchvision.com, you can message us there or through the PitchVision app. You can also do it on Facebook, facebook.com/PitchVisionAcademy, and Twitter @PitchVisionAcad. If you want to listen to this show every week, then go to your favorite podcast app, do a search for PitchVision Academy, and tap or click on the subscribe button. You'll get that for free every Friday. And if you want to get all the show notes, listen to any of the old shows, download the shows directly onto your computer or device, or stream the show from your device itself, you can do all that over at pitchvision.com. Just go to pitchvision.com/academy and click on the podcast link for all the details. That's all for this week. We hope you listen next week. But until then, have a good week. Cheers, Gareth.
Cheers, fella.